Okay, this is Agent Ladybug, and today on spyman.ca in our exposed show, today is Monday, April the 2nd, 2007, and we're again very, very proud to have our special guest, David Hawkins. Now, David Hawkins has a website called Hawks Cafe, which I invite every one of our listeners to get into. If you have any information, please send it to David as well. So welcome, David Hawkins. And we have also Eric Hufschmid, and Eric is going to have a number of questions to ask. So I'm going to ask Eric to get into one or two questions that you have for David as well. So welcome, David and Eric both.
Hello there.
Yeah, hello. I'm here too.
Okay, now, if you could kindly, Eric, ask him any questions that you want for the American populace that wants to know about this major draft that you're in the process of writing right now, but this is going to be an actual civil claim. Am I right?
Is that a question to me, Ladybug?
Yes, to you first, yes.
Hello?
Yes, is it a civil claim?
Yes, it is. It's under RICO statute, which was introduced in October 1970, which has a criminal and a civil component. And the civil remedy makes it possible to claim triple damages if you can demonstrate that the defendants are part of a group, that they all have a relationship with a group that has continuity, that commits a number of predicate acts. And one particular act that we're focused on is the use of the group or the network to provide murder for hire services, which we think we can prove stretched back to the 1970s in the Arkansas correction system. And in the 90s, they developed a technology called virtual private networking, which is actually embedding a secure communications links between the members inside a normal communication system. So it could be the telephone system from AT&T, it could be the Boeing satellite systems known as Iridium and Thuraya, or it could be Nortel's voice over internet protocol system. So the regular users aren't aware that there's an encrypted system. And the technical phrase is called tunneling. Anyway, we think we can prove, stretching back to the 70s and in the early 90s, around 1993, when Al Gore and his colleagues in the Department of Justice bought in the entire production of AT&T's secure telephony system, we think that we can demonstrate that that secure system was used tunneling into government federal departments, Department of State, Department of Commerce, and Department of Justice, to execute contract hits on targets and enemies within the government and within industry.
Eric, do you have any questions right now for...
Yeah, well, yesterday you brought up some interesting points about Al Gore and Clinton, and how they have been deeply involved in crimes. And, you know, for us, during that period, the only thing anybody would ever talk about publicly was Monica Lewinsky. They were ignoring all of these crimes that you talk about. And even today, you don't see anybody bringing them up, not even the Republicans. They still are letting him get away with everything. And yet, what is peculiar is, how is it that Al Gore and the Clintons can have so much control that nobody can touch them? All they can bring up is maybe Monica Lewinsky. And what it brings you to is 9/11 right now. They're attacking Rosie O'Donnell and Charlie Sheen, anybody who talks about 9/11. And what this leads you to is, why is the media so defensive of Al Gore, Bill Clinton?
Well, I think I can respond to that. Essentially, what people don't understand is that Gore and Clinton, through this co-opting of the virtual private network technology, they actually bought the product or the entire production from AT&T using a stash of money confiscated by the Department of Justice from the drug trade. And my analysis suggests that the two most powerful organized crime families in North America from the time of the hit in 1981 when the alleged shooter came down from Montreal, and he's going to be facing trial in New York sooner or later. He's in custody in New York. But a man by the name of Vito Rizzuto, who was the head or the alleged head of the Rizzuto crime family, he came down in 1981 and alleged helped to knock out three capos that were giving Big Joey Bonanno, Big Joey Massino, a bit of trouble in the organized crime activities in New York. And he went back to Montreal, which is a classic technique, and the cleanup crews, union guys and mob bosses and capos and so on, they took the bodies away and got rid of them. But from 1981 to 2004, when Joey Massino started to sing like a canary, the judge, when he was convicted, said that he had orchestrated 25 years of arson, murder, gambling, racketeering, extortion and fraud in New York. So the problem that we face is, both in the United States and in Canada, now that they have these virtual private networks, they can discreetly send a message to anyone, I would argue, including the Prime Minister of Canada and the President of the United States, telling them what they can do to stay alive and what if they continue to do, they're going to die, because they can be hit anywhere. Remember, on 9/11, there were people working in the U.S. Naval Command Center in the Pentagon, for example, Captain Gerald Oconto, and if you'd said on the Monday, the 10th of September 2001, that something was going to fly through the window of the U.S. Naval Command Center and kill him, I presume he would have laughed out loud. However, on the morning of September the 11th, a bunch of guys with box cutters managed to fly a weapons platform across the Pentagon lawn at 540 miles an hour and destroy the U.S. Naval Command Center, a major strategic asset, and we're still pretending that this was done by guys who'd been trained to wield box cutters in the caves in Afghanistan.
Well, but then you're saying they're also controlling not just the Republicans and the Democrats, but the media?
Oh, absolutely. For example, on Ron Brown's plane that went down in Yugoslavia, and just think of it in purely in terms of racketeering and extortion. So a guy called Leon Panetta, who worked with Al Gore and Webster Hubble and Janet Reno on buying up the secure technology, the AT&T secure telephony technology, Leon Panetta was supposed to be on that plane. At the last minute, he didn't go, but Ron Brown and very senior people from the U.S. Department of Commerce went, a bunch of United States Air Force officers, pilot, crew, etc., etc., and a journalist from the New York Times, various representatives of the CIA and security, and they all died. So I guess the signal to the people, including the New York Times and the media, is just don't mess with us or you're dead. So I believe you've got a horrifying position deeply embedded in all your arms of government, and actually, amazingly enough, it's even worse in Canada. There is a racketeering influenced and corrupt organization operating a murder for hire network with virtual private networks so that they can send a discreet message either by voice internet protocol through Nortel, through Boeing's Iridium satellite communications, or the telephony system. And they can warn their target that they do one thing and they'll stay alive, and if they do another thing, they're going to die. And the remarkable thing is, through this Carlisle Canada group, is they can take out life insurance on the victims just before they're killed.
Well, then, where do you see the Israelis or the Zionists playing much of a role in this, or where do you see them in this connection?
At the moment, my research, and as I said to Ladybug yesterday, I'm a forensic economist, so I follow the evidence. I see a number, and it's really paradoxical, I see a number of Jews being targeted through a false flag technique. For example, when the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey sold the 99-year lease to Larry Silverstein, everyone says Larry Silverstein owned the 99-year lease on that building. Well, of course, that was $3.2 billion, which Larry Silverstein didn't have. I think he put in about $30 to $40 million, which is chump change when you look at $3.2 billion. What Larry Silverstein did he went to a mortgage broker called the General Motors Acceptance Corporation, and the General Motors Acceptance Corporation used a piece of software called Mindbox. And what Mindbox will do, it will arrange or structure a loan, so it sits in what's called the lender's workflow. And it's a program called, it's an artificial intelligence program using rule or case-based techniques, which I can tell you about some other time. But what they'll do is they'll look at the amount of revenue being generated in interest on a loan, in this case to Larry Silverstein, of the balance of the money, which came from the big union pension funds through the mortgage broker GMAC, including the firefighters' variable supplements fund, which is the pension fund of the senior officers of the firefighters who went in and died on 9/11. So what Mindbox will do automatically, once it's been programmed, it will continuously adjust the terms of the insurance to match the terms or the recovery of investment through debt interest and principal payments. And if, for example, the borrower looks like is going to be unable to pay the rent or pay the interest payments and the principals, then the building that is the subject of the insurance policy or the mortgage which is the subject of the insurance policy can be adjusted so that in the case of the Twin Towers, if they both came down together, the lender could put in a claim for a double occurrence.
Yeah,
so instead of getting their $3.2 billion or $3.6 billion back, they would get $7.2 billion, and they run that through a corrupt court, which is the Southern District Court of New York, with a jury trial, and I allege a number of kickbacks to the judges and the various other people, and amazingly, the conclusion was, through the jury, that this was a double occurrence, and therefore the insured party was entitled to claim twice the money of the loan.
Right. So you're saying,
so in fact, so Silverstein was actually set up, and I believe he was set up because he was Jewish. So he went into this unknowingly, but the General Motors Acceptance Corporation, which is controlled through the Carlyle Group, took out a bogus property insurance that was continuously adjusted during the period of the hijacking, or the simulated hijacking, and just prior to the second tower coming down, they'd maximized the insurance policy that paid up a huge profit by virtue of the fact that an event that was, from the investor's point of view, extremely unlikely, i.e. both towers coming together and coming down in the same series of events, would generate a profit to the insured parties.
So then you're saying the people within this Carlyle group are way at the top in the decision-making and the planning and the control. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. This is essentially, there are two phrases here that people need to understand. There's the virtual private network, which Al Gore, using drug money from organized crime, stored in the Department of Justice, so it didn't appear under the congressional accounting or scrutiny. So, for example, so really what this was dirty money with some links back to, I believe, the Bonanno and Rizzuto crime families in 1993 controlled the drug trade in North America. So they would have known about that money, and they would have been very interested in a secure communication system for future drug trades. So I believe what we'll be able to demonstrate is that the criminal organizations went into a joint venture with the Clinton-Gore White House and the Department of Justice to develop a virtual private network for virtual private equity groups. And the virtual private equity groups then had an insider position on the insurance policy on the Twin Towers, the passengers and the planes, and the ability to, I don't know if this is an understandable concept, and remember this isn't my background, I'm really an engineer, I've drifted into this, they were long in New York and they were short in Chicago, meaning if the shares went up in New York they'd make money. But if they went down in New York, they would make money in Chicago. And that's what actually happened. The bank which made huge shorting profits in Chicago was UBS, which is the world's largest private bank. And UBS was handling investments, wait for it, from the Bin Laden family and the family of Saddam Hussein.
Well, okay, then what about the Carlyle Group? Who do you see is in this one then? Because I thought most people refer to them as being basically Republicans.
I personally don't care what their political affiliations is. I mean, when you're dealing with organized crime, they can be communists, Democrats, Greens, or etc. The reason for not going political on this is when we take these people into court through this lawsuit, which is basically built around the wrongful death associated with a crime that we call Arkansine, because it dates back to the 70s and the Arkansas prison system, through to Kyoto 911, and we allege that Kyoto 911 was a war game structured to go bad and eliminate the competition to the globalists' wish to control carbon dioxide emissions in the commons and make $50 a ton. So whether it's Republican or someone keeps banging this term neoconservatives past me, I'll be blunt with you. I'm not interested in terms like neoconservative. I'm interested in terms like, are they operating a murder for hire network? Because that is a violation of a U.S. code, which is part of the predicate calculus as to whether or not we can prove in front of a jury that they are members of a racketeering, influenced, and corrupt organization responsible for wrongful death. And we have a list of 100 defendants that I'm working on now with my colleagues, and whether there's 100 Republicans there or 100 Democrats there, I don't care.
Oh, well, yeah, I know what you mean about the terms, but because a lot of the people in America, as we're looking through it, there are some Israeli involvement somehow in this. It's hard. Even Israel is boasting in the last elections that they just got more of their candidates in our government. They were boasting in their own newspapers. They just got more Jews, they were saying. More Jews than ever are now in the
Well, I don't know what you want me to say to that.
No,
I'm following
what is their involvement in all this? Because they have to have some involvement. It's just a question of what is it. It's not that...
Well, I think you. If you tell me they have to have some involvement, and it's up to you to prove it. I've got 670 people in the members of Hortz Cafe. They can all find my email. Some people are providing me with the most extraordinary insights into 9/11, and
you don't
ultimately
think
that's my focus. Sorry?
What do you mean, you don't think they played any significant role in 9/11? Or the corruption?
No, I'm not
that
saying that.
About?
The evidence that I have at the moment doesn't point that way.
Or in the other corruption that you see, the media corruption or the corruption in the Canadian government, you don't see them as playing a significant role then?
I see a much bigger role of organized crime.
But I mean, the organized crime, see, the question is, who is the organized crime? And, you know, it's not, when it's trying to figure out who are they and who.
Well, that's what I've done. I've got now, the case will be against the Boeing Board of Directors. And remember, if we come back to 9/11, what was orchestrated on 9/11 was a brilliant double cross during a war game. Now, the war game that was taking place, setting aside whether or not you want me to prove that the Israelis were involved, the war game of 9/11 was called Global Guardian, and it was set up. The script for that war game was written by a company in Ottawa, Canada, by the name of Lansdowne Technologies, which is controlled by Paul Martin. And Paul Martin's, and he was the former Prime Minister of Canada, and Paul Martin and his family control or own Canada Steamship Lines. And Canada Steamship Lines, 3 days after the federal election in Canada on November of 2003, the flagship vessel of Canada Steamship Lines, which as far as I know was built in China by the People's Liberation Army of China, was found to have 86 kilograms of cocaine in a hatch below the waterline.
Oh, yeah.
Now, one swallow does not a summer make, but my point is that we have a lot of evidence with Al Gore using drug money to buy in that virtual private network, and Canada's Steamship Lines, which is the world's largest self-unloading fleet, and at least one particular vessel to be found to be moving cocaine, as that this virtual private network that I talk about that was absolutely fundamental to executing 9/11 and bypassing American defenses would appear to be financed by international drug trafficking.
Oh, that could be, but I'm just saying that, like, Christopher Bolin has noticed that the software for the air traffic controllers in the U.S. military, NORAD, a lot of that is coming from Israeli companies. And then
if you're interviewing me, I'll tell you what I know, I happen to know the software manufacturer that designed and built the software that steers steered the planes into the buildings on 9/11.
And
would you like to hear? Would you like to hear the name?
Yeah.
Okay, it's a company called McDonnell Detweiler and Associates in Richmond, British Columbia, Canada. I know the founder of that company, John McDonnell. I met him in 1995 because I, through my company, or a big defense contractor back in the United Kingdom, a company called Racal Defense Electronics, were interested in buying that company. And I met John McDonnell in 1995. And in 1995, it would appear that McDonnell Detweiler was acquired by Orbital Sciences of Dulles, Virginia, and then in a reverse takeover by extortion, McDonnell Detweiler was brought back under the control of the CAI Carlyle Canada private equity group. And on May the 3rd, 2001, McDonnell Detweiler announced that it had developed the software for the United States Air Force and the Federal Aviation Administration called Instrument Approach Procedures, and I will quote from memory, so I won't have it exactly right, but people can visit McDonnell Detweiler's website on May the 3rd, 2001, and see that quote. This software allows you to take a plane off its regular en route airway, execute maneuvers, and fly by instruments through waypoints, avoiding obstacles and interceptions using a point and click for the operator, which can be in an accompanying aircraft, like a Bombardier combat support jet, or operated by air traffic controllers of the Federal Aviation Administration. Now, on the morning of 9/11, you may not be aware of that, and Americans should understand the extent to which these organizations, such as the FAA, have been penetrated by organized crime. The air traffic controllers participating in the 9/11 war game, using the software from McDonnell Detweiler and Associates, were members of the Laborers International Union of North America, Local 2097 in Oklahoma City. And you may or may not know, but in 1995, the Laborers International Union of North America was the subject of a draft RICO complaint by the U.S. Department of Justice, RICO being the Racketeering, Influenced, and Corrupt Organization. And what the U.S. Department of Justice wanted to do was to take all the assets of the Laborers International Union of North America and put them under a government trusteeship and clean the mob out. Now, the problem for the Department of Justice, or at least those honorable people that were around at that time, and I don't think there were many left, the problem was that the laborers had made a $3 million donation to the Clinton's second presidential election campaign. And in February of 1995, the Department of Justice, I believe, was forced to drop its draft racketeering complaint, and the laborers' union was allowed to police itself and employ 50 senior FBI officers to clean out the mob. And if you do your homework, you'll find that many, many good members of the laborers' union said that this is a sham, because all that's happened is that the FBI have been paid to clean out the competition to the then president of the laborers' union, a guy called Arthur Coyer, who was a bosom buddy of Hillary and Bill Clinton. So on the morning of 9/11, the software that I allege steered the planes into the buildings was operated from the ground by a mobbed up members of the laborers' union. And the laborers' union pension fund, I suggest, was invested long in New York but short in Chicago, and a huge amount of profits were made by collapsing the stock markets that was kicked back to senior people inside the union, which many of its members alleged is still a mobbed up racketeering controlled union.
And weren't they doing the stock things in Europe and Japan also, not just Chicago? Wasn't
no,
it?
Yes. Yes, to a lesser extent, but the main, it had been structured because, and this I think is why they forced the Boeing board of directors to move down to Chicago from Washington State, where the mob could keep their eyes on them. And if you look at the geography of Chicago, around the Chicago River, it's very interesting because one North Wacker Drive, which is the east side of the Chicago River, as I understand, if you look to the northeast, you can see the Boeing corporate headquarters. if you look to the southwest, you can see the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. The intriguing thing is that One North Wacker Drive was built for UBS, the bank which was handling investments for Saddam Hussein's family and the Bin Laden family in Chicago, such that if there was a major panic on the New York Stock Exchange, a huge amount of money would be made in the derivatives market in Chicago by UBS. And that would be kicked back to the senior people in the Bin Laden and the Saddam Hussein family. So when the Americans arrived in Iraq in 2003, some Marines kicked down a wall, and behind it they found $742 million of nice, crisp American banknotes that had been shipped to Saddam Hussein by UBS, meaning that Saddam got a kickback after 9/11 from the bank, which had gone short in Chicago in the derivatives market. But the office tower that UBS had built in Chicago was built by a British company called AMEC, and AMEC was also, on the morning of 9/11, conducting sabotage vulnerability testing in the Pentagon, the electronic trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange, and towers 1, 2, and 7 in Manhattan, and the Logan Airport baggage screening area. So you have a British company that was brought in, and these contracts would have dated back to the probably the Office of Construction Management with the Department of the Interior. They were fraudulent contracts given to the AMEC, the British company, I believe to use militant members of the Laborers' Union and a virtual private network to do sabotage testing, and through this backdoor virtual private network determine whether or not the blue team defenders had relaxed their or dropped their guard such that they could switch from a simulated sabotage operation to a real sabotage operations. And they found on the morning of 9/11 that the blue team defenses relaxed, they switched to a real attack, and there was too little time, given that the fact that the red team or the blue team was equipped with a tunneling network inside its regular communication systems. Effectively, they knocked out the blue team communication systems.
So you're saying a British company had the security system for Logan Airport? It was a British company that was in charge of that?
Correct. Correct. It also had the security system, and the it had just completed construction on the U.S. Naval Command Center in Wedge 1 of the Pentagon. It was obviously a fraudulent contract given by insiders. It set up the U.S. Pentagon communications such, if you can think of it, there was a Trojan horse inside the Pentagon. And on the morning of 9/11, whatever it was that knocked out the U.S. Naval Command Center and killed Captain Gerald DeConto fried the electrical and electronic communication systems, the wire and wireless communication systems in the Pentagon. And this is absolutely amazing, and you won't find this in the media. The Nortel Voice Internet Protocol System, which was controlled by Carlisle Canada, was switched from the Pentagon over to Europe and NATO. So the communication link between the President of the United States and the Vice President and U.S. naval assets around the world was ruptured. And communications with those naval assets, I think we can prove, was handed off to a dual-use civilian fleet run by Canada's steamship lines and the Communist Party Liberation Army of China.
Oh, well, I see. Yeah, because over here, nobody has really been looking at the British connection much. They've been noticing some of the Israeli connections, but then no one can figure out what level anyone is at, whether they're the low-level workers or whether they're...
Yeah, well, they're being pointed to look at the Israelis to divert attention. It's classical psyops, psychological operations. And with these virtual private networks, you see the whole story about the collapse of the building was developed at the School of Architecture at MIT, and it was ready to be inserted through these virtual private networks onto the Internet. So if you look on the day after, now normally with a crime as complex as that, and remember there were four different scenes of crime, each one of them should have been the subject of a separate investigation. And a proper investigation would not automatically have assumed that what happened in the field outside Shanksville, Pennsylvania, was connected with what happened at Logan Airport when Muhammad Atta went through. Anyway, lo and behold, miraculously, in the parkade of Logan Airport, where, as I told you, that AMEC, the British company, was working on the baggage screening systems, they discover a car or a van inside some carry-on luggage for some reason that wasn't carried on by Muhammad Atta. They open the luggage, and inside they find a list of 19 names, a Quran, last will and testament of Muhammad Atta, and a flight training manual. So lo and behold, someone plants a piece of evidence that tells everyone who these people are. So we all rush off to Afghanistan. But if you look at the operation that was structured on 9-1-1, remember, it was a war game.
Yeah, what do you mean when you say it was, the collapse of the towers was developed? How did you say that? What did you mean by that? You said
there's a guy called Thomas Eger, who's a professor of architecture at MIT.
Right.
And the story, if you check at what happened at MIT, there were four or five people at MIT who had prior knowledge of 9-1-1. The most obvious is a professor of chemistry at MIT by the name of John Deutsch. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, the CIA or... CIA?
Yeah, the CIA guy, director, appointed by Clinton, who was fired in 1995 or early 1996 because he took and placed on his home computer 17,000 pages of top secret CIA information detailing, it would appear, the names and addresses and identities and skill sets of all the CIA's Mideast operatives, including two guys, one by the name of Osama bin Laden and the other by the name of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And the name of that database, of which our friend John Deutsch stole a copy, was an Arab name meaning base, which is called Al Qaeda.
Right. Yeah, I've heard that one.
So,
well, what did Thomas Eger do?
Thomas Eger was a professor of architecture at MIT.
Well, I know he came out with a paper explaining it, but when you say it was developed ahead of time, what did you mean by that?
He said that prior to, and you have to dig around a bit, Eger says that prior to 9/11 happening, they had been looking at the possibility of what would cause a collapse of the towers. And they had a paper partially written to explain how a collapse like this might occur. Now, the intriguing thing about MIT, it has a center which was started in 1991, which is called the Center for Coordination Science. It changed its name last year to the Center for Collective Intelligence, which is rather an Orwellian term. But you can imagine with John Deutsch stealing that CIA information, he shared it on his home computers. The natural place to place it, I believe, would be the companies where John Deutsch became a director afterwards, which includes Raytheon and Citigroup, and Citigroup was in the building number 7, and of course the Center for Coordination Science at MIT. Now, one of Deutsch's great friends at MIT is Noam Chomsky.
Oh.
Right? And what Noam Chomsky has said, and I'm paraphrasing his words, and remember, Noam Chomsky is a self-described anarcho-syndicalist. And I don't know if you know what an anarcho-syndicalist is, and I've had to check it up in the dictionary, but an anarcho-syndicalist would appear to believe that the world industry and government should be controlled by one big union.
Oh, I see.
All right? And what is legitimate for such a one big union to do is to use anything ranging from terror, sabotage, and general strikes to extort control over the global commons or production and distribution in the global commons, if we follow the Hegelian dialectic of Karl Marx, and transfer controls to the one big union. Well, I believe that there are connections now through organized crime between that core group at MIT and militants and expert saboteurs in the laborers' union. Now, let me give you a little more insights about why Chomsky might be interested in building these links with saboteurs inside the laborers' union. He went to the Lebanon just before the Palestinians kidnapped those Jews that provoked a kind of mini-war, and he totally supported the activities of Hamas. Now, I don't know what your opinion of Hamas is, but let's try and describe what Noam Chomsky's opinion of Hamas. I believe that Chomsky would state that the attacks on America are the legitimate and inevitable response of groups around the world to American imperialism, to which I would reply, bullshit. They are orchestrated attacks on the United States, which is one of the most generous countries in the world that has liberated huge areas of the world from fascist dictatorships in the First World War, the Second World War, and the Korean War. But what Noam Chomsky is a master of, he's a propagandist for these groups. And the long-term dream of overthrowing governments and industry and replacing it with one large union. Now, let me talk about another guy in that little group at MIT. We talked about Deutsch, who is quite obviously a traitor who stole this top-secret information. We talked about Noam Chomsky, who's a radical syndicalist that believes in the overthrow of established governments and replacement of control by a big labor union, such as the laborers. We've got a guy called Paul Gray. Now, Paul Gray was the emeritus chairman or president of MIT Corporation, and from 1990 to 2004, Paul Gray was a director of the Boeing Corporation, where Boeing last year paid the largest fine in corporate history, $615 million, for, amongst others, illegal modification to its planes and export to communist China. And the particular modifications that I'm very interested in with my colleague Phil McConnell at Horst Cafe is the installation of missile gyroscopes in the flight box of these planes such that they could be flown remotely and precisely into targets, and the installation of explosives behind all the doors of the passenger cabin, allowing them to be detonated and vaporized in midair, as was the case of United 93. So you have Paul Gray, a party to the process which resulted in the biggest fine in corporate history, paid by Boeing to the Department of Justice, Eric and Ladybug, to drop its investigation into Boeing.
Yeah,
now, on the morning of 9/11, the Boeing company... I'm sorry?
Sorry, they're able to thwart any court case. That's the power that they have, Boeing and all these major corporations that are part of the Carlyle Group. Maybe if you mentioned
yes,
some of
the... Yes, because what we have to do, if I can just... people have to understand that when you say Boeing does this and Boeing does that, the popular view on the left is it's a big, bad corporation. Now, there are many very excellent engineers. They have some wonderful products inside Boeing, and you can't condemn the entire company as being a mobbed-up operation. And the mob don't need to control the employees to control the company. As you migrate up, you have your senior managers, and ultimately you have your directors on the board of Boeing, the ones that I believe were extorted into moving the company from Washington to Chicago, quite possibly through physical intimidation or threats of murder or blackmail or bribery or whatever. Anyway, suffice it to say, when a company such as Boeing is using working capital that is taken from investors and shareholders, that's what's called equity, then it produces or serves to maximize the value of the investments of the shareholders. That's the duty of the directors. When, however, a company such as Boeing starts borrowing money to finance its production, for example, shipping equipment, military sensitive equipment to communist China, then the problem for the Boeing board of directors is they've got two groups of people that they owe a duty to. The first and foremost should always have been the shareholders who elected them. However, if there's a huge amount of debt in the company from the big banks, such as JP Morgan, to finance production. Eventually, there's a critical point where the company is no longer controlled by the investors through the directors. It's controlled by private equity groups through the lenders. And I suggest that dating back to the time they parachuted Paul Gray from MIT into Boeing on the board of directors, they began to corrupt and control Boeing through debt, which is a classic definition of racketeering, which is the use of unlawful debt to extort an interest, income, or influence over the borrower.
So they've done this repeatedly with all these corporations.
Yes, they've hollowed them out. It's actually a battle for equity. And on 9/11, you see, and that's one of the reasons why the case that we propose to file is so huge. On the morning of 9/11 and the next 4 days, when they sabotaged the electronic trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange, they created what is called an arbitrage opportunity. That is, if they could keep the markets running in Chicago, they could make huge amounts of money selling these companies short, because the arbitrageurs in New York were not able to get into the market because that trading floor had been shut. But the trading floor had been built by AMEC, the same company that sabotaged the Pentagon and the baggage screening area at Logan Airport, and buildings 1, 2, and 7. And in building number 7, on the top floor was Salomon Smith Barney, which is a subsidiary of Citigroup, whose director is John Deutsch.
And where is Queen Elizabeth and all of those people coming in? Because she gave awards to New York City Mayor Giuliani, the police commissioner, and the fire commissioner after 9/11, basically like as a reward for keeping their mouth shut or participating. Where do you see this royal family of Britain?
Well, this is very interesting. And first of all, I don't think if you ask the Queen of England about what she knows about hedge fund trades on the New York Stock Exchange or Chicago, she wouldn't have a clue. She has a group of advisors called, my understanding is, the Privy Council of the United Kingdom, and there is a Privy Council in Canada. Right? And the Privy Council of Canada and the Privy Council of the United Kingdom, they are appointed, they're not elected, for life, and they've established what you might call is a virtual private network of unelected and unaccountable people, including, it would appear, organized crime figures, because, and again, I'm sure this is without the knowledge of the Queen of England, because she's not involved at that level. But in Canada, we have a huge problem of the infiltration of organized crime into government, and Zaccardelli, who's the commissioner of the RCM police, he said in 2001, when he was appointed as chief of, and he's just resigned actually, and there's another scandal that I can talk to you very briefly about, he said, modern crime is so sophisticated, it has got to the heart of government itself, and you've got exactly the same problem in the United States. And then there was another phrase, it wasn't from Zaccardelli, it was a law enforcement conference in Toronto in 2000, I think. And there was a quote from a senior law enforcement person there, said that Canada has become the hub of international drug trafficking, organized fraud, and money laundering for criminal and terrorist groups. And to all intents and purposes, Canada is now the base. And remember, the Arab word for base is Al-Qaeda, I believe has become the base for attacks on the United States, because Americans think of Canada as an ally. But in fact, we are sheltering some of the most dangerous terrorists in the world. And for example, Ahmed Rezam in 1999 was stopped at the Port Angeles border in Washington on his way to Los Angeles to blow up the airport and trigger an artificial and contrived panic through the Y2K computer code changes. Right? But he was caught at the border and he had explosives in his back and he was arrested. But he was trained in Montreal. He was funded in Montreal. He was sponsored from Montreal in Canada. It wasn't the Canadian border guards that stopped him, it was the American border guards. And he was the trigger man for a much bigger attempt to collapse the New York and the American stock markets. So you've been looking in Afghanistan, but in fact, the crime or the terrorist attacks of 9/11 were established through Quebec in its links with Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And we can follow the weapons, we can follow the individuals, and most particularly, we can follow the money, because prior to this Kyoto scam promoted by Al Gore, the world's biggest financial scam was the United Nations Oil for Food program, where approximately $33 billion was collected and kicked back in New York and laundered through Canada to develop the weaponry used in the 9/11 attacks. And we have all the companies associated, two in Ottawa, one by the name of Lansdowne Technologies and the other one Parisian Research Corporation. And Parisian Research Corporation organized defense simulation and training exercises where Arab-speaking hijackers would simulate an attack on the United States.
And where is...
Now, I have... Oh, sorry, go ahead, Eric.
Oh, I was just going to ask about some of our government leaders, like Michael Chertoff. He seemed to be the one who prevented any investigation of that first bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, and then he was there when September 11th attack happened to, again, apparently block any sort of investigations or arrests of anybody involved in that. So what do you see as his connection? See, this is where people wonder how the Israelis fit in, because his family is more of a, they're more interested in Israel than they are America, Canada, or Britain. And you have Dov Zakheim, who was in control of the Pentagon budget, where the $2.4 trillion was lost, which could, that's a lot of money. So how do you see them in the American government? Where would you put Michael Chertoff and some of those people?
Well, I don't try and identify someone that I think is suspicious and place them in the crime. I try and follow the evidence of the crime and see who gets thrown up. Now, going back to, it's vitally important to understand how these virtual private networks, and there's a term that I wasn't familiar with until I looked it up on Wikipedia, and anyone else can just put virtual private network in Wikipedia, and there's a term that I hadn't heard before, but I think it describes exactly what has been done from the beginning of this Arkansas murder for hire network in the 70s. They've tunneled their way into regular communication systems. Now, tunneling means, for example, that you have, I think they call it the DISA, the Department of Information Security Agency, which developed a global information grid for the United States military that allows communications to take place in the event, of a nuclear war between regional combat commanders, the president, and the vice president. Now, what they've done, and this was done, I believe, by Al Gore, Webster Hubble, Janet Reno, and various corrupt insiders of the Department of Justice, they've infiltrated or tunneled a virtual private network into the global information grid that would normally be used by regular military folks and loyal Americans. So, unbeknown to these regular people, at any time there is a communication going on between, let's call them, the co-conspirators planning the 9/11 attack, but they're using encryption. So you could be a regular officer, such as Captain Gerald DeConto, the duty officer of the U.S. Naval Command Center inside the Pentagon on 9/11, playing a war game, that is the blue team side of the war game, which is using the software that I just described from McDonnell Detweiler to fly these hijacked planes remotely. And what you intend to do is to re-hijack a hijacked plane and fly it towards United States Air Force Base and land it safely so that the passengers can be released and everything's hunky-dory. And in the war game, and I learned that from Field McConnell, when the red team is attacking the blue team, of course, the red team doesn't tell the blue team in advance what maneuvers it's going to execute, because the purpose of the war game is to check if the blue team is properly responding to sudden and changing events. At the end of the war game, if the red team has won, the winning condition is the red team has its weapons or assets within a 25-mile radius of the target or 3 minutes. And what is supposed to happen then in a regular war game, the red team commander in the air issues the command, knock it off. And all the red team assets are supposed to immediately turn around and go back to base, and then subsequently there will be what's called a lessons learned or a debriefing session, and the red team and the blue team will sit down and they will find out what weaknesses the blue team had in its defenses. And the key company that does that debriefing, funnily enough, is not American. It's Canadian, it's Lansdowne Technologies, and it's controlled by Carlisle Canada. So what was happening during these war games prior to 9-1-1 is Carlisle Canada was learning what the weaknesses of the blue team were, and I'm not at all sure Carlisle Canada was telling the blue team where they were weak. And what I allege happened is the Carlisle Canada people, which includes Carlucci and Baker, south of the border, and a guy called Demaray and Frank McKenna north of the border, are the four sort of principals of Carlisle Canada. I think they realized that there was a particular vulnerability window. When the blue team were told or heard the command, knock it off, the blue team relaxed, because that was normally the signal for the game is over. Everyone goes home. However, if you have a virtual private network that can actually jam the signals from the blue team that are controlling these planes and actually re-hijack it for the red team, you can take the plane and you can fly it into the building independently of the flying skills of the alleged hijackers, which we know were non-existent. They could not fly large passenger jets, and they certainly couldn't fly large passenger jets in that trajectory over the Pentagon lawn.
Well, the same happened at the World Trade Center. The two jets that came out of Boston crossed over Stewart International Airport at almost the same moment in time. And then,
correct.
And see, that's where they could have landed, and then military exercise planes may have gone up at the same time by people who thought they were running an exercise, and then later they were switched by software into running into the World Trade Center buildings.
Yes, you got it. And we've got a very dramatic DVD coming out through Hawks Cafe, and my colleague's operation has a website called CaptainSherlock.com, because what we're trying to address, I'm not a brain scientist, is my left brain analytical scientific work. A lot of people, you know, they don't feel comfortable with that kind of logic. So we need to deal with right term imagination. So we've got a brilliant man who's producing a DVD with mock-ups and models that will show how we believe they ran a what's called a decoy and drone combination of planes, a bigger plane, a 757 at the front, which was a decoy for Captain DeConto in the Pentagon, and in its radar shadow was a 737, which had been modified for more aerobatic flying and equipped with pulse detonation engines and a thermal lance to knock out the Pentagon communication systems and fly around this gyroscope. So people will, within a couple of weeks, will be able to buy this DVD and see exactly how it was done.
And what's also interesting is that Stewart International Airport was given to a British company. It's one of the few or the only American airport under the control of a British company. And that's
the role of AMEC cannot be overestimated. You see, the major shareholder in AMEC, when it was doing these bogus sabotage testing and bogus continuity of government exercises, was Goldman Sachs. And the man who controlled Goldman Sachs' equity investment at that time is a guy called David Blood. And David Blood is a partner of Al Gore in this Kyoto hedge fund scam called Generation Investments in Washington and London. So it would appear that Al Gore and David Blood, prior to 9/11, had perfected this virtual private network using money confiscated from the international drug trade to buy virtual private networks, tunnel their way into the Pentagon communication systems and the military communication systems, such that as the last minute of the end of the war game, they could issue the command, knock it off, have the blue team stand down and relax its guard, and then switch the planes over from the United States Air Force base commanders, and that would be a simple matter of electronic warfare and jamming, and re-hijack them electronically, punch in the coordinates or download the coordinates of the U.S. Naval Command Center, which, remember, this plane, or whatever it was, that went across the Pentagon lawn, it didn't just take out wedge one of the Pentagon that was under construction, it took out the U.S. Naval Command Center, and our guarantee that they were monitoring the conversation between Captain General DeConto and the Secretary of the Navy as he was killed, and they were using that communication to give the coordinates to the plane and the flight box together with the gyroscope, because I would suggest when we've completed our analysis, we'll find that the nose of the plane hit Captain General DeConto's body before vaporizing it. Now, you can't do that as a box-cutter-wielding hijacker who can barely speak English.
Well, yeah, the flight path of that plane is unrealistic. What about Flight 93? Have you done much into that analysis?
Yes, I think I have done an analysis, and again, as a forensic economist in Canada, all you have to go on is information and images that you get culled from the web. But actually, there's a huge amount of information. It just has to be put together. But if you look at the crater outside Shanksville, Pennsylvania, you'll see that it's a three-finned crater, very small, and it's empty. And all the witnesses that come to the scene, or that are allowed on the scene, said they didn't see any plane. They didn't see any debris.
Yeah, it doesn't look like a plane hit there. It looks more like a missile.
No, I'll tell you what happened. I believe these convoys, they were a decoy and drone convoy. There was a 757 with a smaller 737 in its shadow. The 737 had been modified in Canada, in British Columbia, by a company called Cascade Aerospace. This is my allegation. Outside the reach of American RICO, Racketeering Influence and Corrupt Organization statute. Because there you've got a greater chance of picking up a conspiracy than in Canada, because Canada is basically the system for picking up organized crime is collapsed, maybe through bribery or maybe through extortion. Anyway, what Cascade Aerospace does in Abbotsford in British Columbia, which incidentally was the staging post for the war games of June the 1st and 2nd, where they tested an attack on the Capitol building, is it takes out the fuselage paneling, removes the insulation, and replaces it with a new kind of insulation that looks like a rubber sheet. That is, it's got two white sides, the exterior is white, and the interior is a black layer. And my allegation is that that black layer is actually solid propellant rocket fuel. And unknown to the technicians that are installing the insulation, and quite possibly insulation inside the plane seat and the headrest, all of that material passes a flammability test, because the rocket fuel needs a temperature of 1600 degrees Fahrenheit before it will ignite. So even in a regular fire with jet fuel, even if you had perfect oxygen supply, what they call in thermodynamics a stoichiometric ratio, you wouldn't get more than about 1300 degrees Fahrenheit. Normally they're around 600 or 700 degrees. So for example, the flames in the North Tower with the black smoke are probably around 700 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, when you ignite, or if you ignite, these solid propellant rocket fuels that are actually disguised as insulation, they burn, Eric, at 5,800 degrees Fahrenheit. And you would turn the interior of the fuselage of the plane into a rocket engine. Blast the tail off. And I think if people Google for crater and Flight 93, the image, they'll see the crater. I think what happened is they blew the tail off. That fell backwards and downwards into the ground, burning or reacting as it went with this 5,800 degrees Fahrenheit, vaporizing the ground. And that's why the crater inside the ground is empty.
Yeah.
What people say when they came to the scene, they heard the sound of dripping plastic in the forest. There was one engine about 1,000 meters or 100 meters from the site where they said the plane was flown in by the passengers. All right, but the debris field stretches over Indian Lake to New Baltimore, which is 8 miles.
Right. Well, what also confuses Flight 93 is that Cleveland Airport was giving out reports that the Flight 93 landed. They were describing it as Flight 93. And
yes, that's right. And I think what they happened, and it's really hard because, and it was designed to confuse people, I think there were two planes that both been painted with the America, with the United Airlines colors, which is a service that is done by Cascade Aerospace in British Columbia. They were both given false tail numbers, right? They were both converted inside the flight box illegally by Boeing adding this gyrochip missile gyroscope and the avionics that would allow you to fly it remotely through Boeing's operated Iridium and Thuraya satellite communications. And incidentally, Boeing Thuraya satellite communication systems operates out of Abu Dhabi, and I used to live just down the road there in Dubai. And Thuraya communication systems operated by Boeing is the preferred communication systems of the Al-Qaeda alleged terrorist group. So Al-Qaeda expert terrorists were patched in to the communication systems by Boeing through Iridium into the flight box of the planes allegedly hijacked on 911. So Al-Qaeda expert terrorists or mission commanders were able to fly those planes remotely.
Yeah, so, and why do you think they wanted the war with Afghanistan and Iraq, though? This is the other thing that...
No. You've got to... First of all, I believe the diversion to Afghanistan was the way the domestic false flag creating script writers had set it up is they wanted Bush to go into Afghanistan, and they'd created a decoy with Osama bin Laden, who, remember, was a CIA agent in the 80s.
Right.
Right. He was fighting the Soviets, and he was working at that time as an ally of America.
Right.
And the foreign policy of getting the Soviets out of Afghanistan. But the way they'd structured 911 was that the Iraqi intelligence services, Saddam Hussein, had set up through Canada this bogus false flag operation. And in my research, I've just discovered that in 1996, 97 through to 2001, the Iraqi intelligence services were developing a decoy and drone maneuver using a Czechoslovak training system and remote flying platforms equipped with the gyrochip missile gyroscope provided through China by BEI Industries of Little Rock, Arkansas, brokered through the former boss of Hillary Clinton, a guy called Joe Girouard. So the Rose Law Firm in Little Rock, Arkansas, was providing the technology through China, laundered through China, back into Iraq, and Iraq was providing the solid propellant rocket fuel and the flight boxes and the maneuvers to take out an American aircraft carrier in the Gulf in a partnership with the Canadians, preparing the script for the war game. So, in my opinion, if you follow the weaponry and the special weapons and tactics, the right place for the Americans to go after 911 was, first of all, pay a visit to Quebec, where you will find that the virtual private networks used on 911 in a city called Gatineau on the north side of the Ottawa River, and the NATO flight training school in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, where the maneuvers of 911 for the alleged war games were developed, executed, and perfected.
Yeah.
After that, the next place to go to was Saddam Hussein, because it was Saddam Hussein's money stolen from the UN Oil Food Program, laundered through New York, that funded the development of the weapons in Canada.
Well, I have a name. Sorry, Eric, I just wanted to get this question. Leo Wanta, I think, is his name. He did some of the weaponry and the money that was given to Saddam Hussein, but they printed funny money. Do you know anything about Leo Wanta? And,
no, I don't, but I do know that the money that they found in Iraq in 2003, the $742 million, it was brand new American banknotes that had been shipped by UBS, and remember UBS ran the hedge fund scam in Chicago through 911, made huge profits for investors, many of them including the pension fund investors unknowing to the members, such as the New York City Employees Retirement System, including the firefighters. So they were actually investing in terrorist companies, or companies that were trading with terrorist state-sponsored terrorism in Iraq. Anyway, UBS paid a $100 million fine to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York for shipping nice new banknotes to Saddam Hussein to buy weapons to kill American and British and Australian and soldiers. So it's quite extraordinary. Boeing, by paying $615 million fine to the Department of Justice to drop investigations, in my opinion, admits to liability in respect to the wrongful deaths of 9/11. And UBS, in sending $742 million of crisp American banknotes and paying a $100 million fine to Saddam, admits to funding or supporting countries that support the terrorist attack on 9/11. So we need, in this lawsuit, we will be going after the principals inside UBS and Boeing and the private equity groups that control them both. And it comes back to Carlyle.
Well, that could be, what you're saying makes a lot of sense. What I see as a possibility, you know, you talk about hijacking the airplanes through software that no one knows about, you know, hijacked planes. What I see as a possibility is that this Carlyle group and the other people are also being hijacked, in other words, manipulated by Israel as to divert the attempt to modify their plans a little to help get rid of their neighbors. Do you know what I mean? The blackmail and double crossing, I think, seems so much more extreme. That when you have a group this big, there are people within the group plotting against each other, trying to manipulate what the attack is going to be.
Eric, what you're speculating, you see, and if it leads to Israel, so be it. But when you get to Carlyle, for example, Carlyle, Canada, you get to people like Peter Bentley, who's on the International Advisory Council with Paul Desmarais of J.P. Morgan, which is Rockefeller and Kissinger. Okay, so I don't know how high you want to go, and you do seem very, very anxious to lead me towards investigating Israel. I'm not saying that it doesn't point that way, but everything is possible. But if we go back to Sherlock Holmes, and people should visit the CaptainSherlock.com website, what Sherlock Holmes said is, once you've excluded the impossible, the improbable, no matter how unlikely, is true.
I'm not saying that Israel is only involved. I'm saying I see them as a lot of the workforce. They are the ones with the software development abilities, the ability.
Now, I've just told you that McDonald Detweiler and Associates developed the software on instructions and using vendor financing from Carlyle Canada, the software called Instrument Approach Procedure and Final Approach Procedure for the Federal Aviation Administration of the United States Air Force Base to fly planes remotely.
Well, that's right, but what I'm saying is all you need is one Israeli...
McDonald Detweiler is not an Israeli company.
All you need is
it's
one...
there in British Columbia.
But all you need is one Zionist within the company to hijack that software, which is hijacking other software.
That's speculation.
But you see, it's the same with everything else. Who put the explosives in those towers, for example?
Well, AMEC did, and let me explain again. AMEC had access through the French and American Foundation to solid propellant rocket fuel being produced by Saddam under this bogus United Nations Monitoring, Verification and Inspection Commission. And what he was doing, and he shipped probably around 400 tons of solid propellant rocket fuel through France. Now, 400 tons of solid propellant rocket fuel, remember, disguised because it's an elastomer as insulation, meaning you can make a ceiling panel. You know those sort of square ceiling panels that go in the roof above the office?
Right, you can hide it.
It looks exactly like insulation.
So you think they're the manpower. They are the manpower that did it, and they're the source of the explosives.
Well, what AMEC did, AMEC had reason because it was building the diesel tank systems and lines in building number 7, which, as you know, came down at 520, in a partnership with Citigroup. And Citigroup's director is John Deutsch. And John Deutsch is the as-yet unincarcerated guy who's a director of the CIA who stole the Al-Qaeda database from the CIA. I mean, what more evidence does one? You've got Citigroup, Salomon Smith Barney was admitted liability in the WorldCom scam. All the evidence was in the top floors of the building number 7.
Oh, I'm not disagreeing. I'm saying we just hadn't looked into that company. We hadn't heard of it before. So we can look into that one, too. I'm just saying that I'm just saying when you look at some previous things that Israel has done, like the King David Hotel bombing in 1946, it's like a miniature version of 9/11 without airplanes. You know, that was when they...
Well, I would argue that actually the attack on the World Trade Center in 1993 is much more like the attack that was successful on 9/11, particularly because the guys who did it, the two expert terrorists as opposed to what are called the expendables, one guy's name is Ramzi Youssef, all right, and his alleged uncle is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and both of them were traveling under Iraqi passports and Kuwaiti passports stolen from the occupation in 1991.